We hope you find this WILL podcast to be valuable. A $10 voluntary credit card contribution at willpledge.org will help us continue to make podcasts of our programs available. Thank you. And that address again is willpledge.org. WILLPLEDGE.ORG. Now here's your program.
Good morning. Welcome to Focus 580. This is our morning talk program. My name is David Inge, and we're glad to have you with us. This morning on Focus, we'll be talking with an investigative journalist who has spent the last 20 years or so working to uncover new evidence about unsolved murders from the civil rights era. And our guest is Jerry Mitchell. He works for the Clarion Ledger newspaper in Jackson, Mississippi. And his work has led to convictions in a number of major cases, including the assassination of civil rights leader Medgar Evers, and also the 1964 murders of civil rights workers Michael Schwerner, Andrew Goodman, and James Chaney. He's received more than 30 national awards for his work, including the George Polk Award twice. He was a finalist for the Pulitzer Prize in 2006. He's won the Sigma Delta Chi Award for public service, the Haywood Bruin Award, and most recently, he won a MacArthur Foundation Genius Grant. He's always generous with his time to talk about this work, and we're pleased that he could spend a little bit of time with us this morning on the program talking about it. Questions from people who are listening are certainly welcome. The only thing that we ask of callers is that people are brief so we can keep moving and get as many callers in as possible, but certainly questions from listeners are welcome. Our number here in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455, and toll-free, 800-222-9455. At any point here, your questions, comments are certainly welcome. Mr. Mitchell, thanks for talking with us today.
You bet.
We appreciate the time. I'm sure that for probably a lot of reporters would say, reporters who had gotten big stories, they would say that probably tenacity certainly has a lot to do with it, but also luck, I suppose, in a way has something to do with it.
Sure.
And for you, what do you think really was the thing that, I mean, you've stuck with this and you've been made this a kind of a special focus for you, but was there something in particular that for you, you would have said, well, if I had to point to one time, one place, one thing, this was really the thing that opened the door for me?
Well, I think probably what started the journey for me was I went to see the movie Mississippi Burning, which is obviously a fictional film, but I saw it in January of 1989 with two FBI agents who investigated those killings, as well as a journalist who covered it. And to be honest with you, I really knew nothing about it. And so it was really eye-opening to me. I really knew nothing about it. I was a child at the time the killings took place. And so it was, and I grew up in a different state. I grew up in Texas. So it just blew my mind, all the things that took place, this really took place. And they kind of dissected the whole film for me. Oh, this happened or this didn't happen. And kind of explained what really happened. And it was just, I couldn't believe the fact that there were more than 20 guys, Klansmen, involved in that killing, and none of them had ever been prosecuted for murder. Mm. And so that's kind of what began my journey. And from that point forward, I was kind of focused on that case and eventually other cases as well.
Yeah. And I think among the things about your story that I think is really amazing is that you – then were able to, you know, that you said the thing that really got you going, really moved you, was seeing this movie.
Mm-hmm.
And that then later, what's really amazing here is that later on you would meet and write about the man who planned that murder.
Yeah.
And as a result of the stories you wrote, that really helped contribute to the effort to convict him.
Yeah, they reopened the case, and he was convicted in 2005 on the exact anniversary a great killing was.
Mm-hmm.
of the killings of those kids. You know, that many years later. It's amazing. You know, it kind of went full circle. I started off writing about that case, and then I wrote about the Megar Evers case, and that case was reopened and prosecuted, and several others as well. So it's been an amazing journey. It's one of those things, I didn't necessarily set out to do all these cases. I didn't, like, sit down one day and go, okay, I'm going to do all these cases. I didn't. I just kind of did them one at a time, if that makes sense.
Yeah. Well, and I expect, I'm sure what happens is once you do one, then your name gets associated with that kind of work, then if there are other people who have something to pass on to you, they say, okay, well, this is the guy that I'm going
to call. And that's exactly what happened after Byron Dale Beckles was indicted in 1990 in the Megler Evers case. I had the Vernon Dahmer family come to me a few months later and just say, hey, we need your help. We want, our dad's killers prosecuted. And so I agreed to help them. And so that eventually led to prosecution and conviction of Sam Bowers, who was the Imperial Wizard of the White Knights here in Mississippi, the Ku Klux Klan. Mm. And so he was convicted in 98 in that case. And it seems like all these cases, you're talking about the amount of time from the time that the story runs to when the conviction takes place is really kind of amazing. I mean, it's the initial story is sometimes a real gap of time, but then sometimes it moves quickly. It's really kind of fascinating.
Yeah, one of the things that I know, having read about you, is that you grew up in the South. You grew up in Texas, but
Which is very southern. I grew up in Texas, it's East Texas, and it's very southern. It's not that different from Mississippi.
And you I know that at the time that the things that you ended up having written about were really going on, you were like 3-4 years old. So it wasn't something that you had lived through personally.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly.
And that you say, and I'm sure that it's true of a lot of other people of our generation, because it's not something that we live through, our personal connection to it is not, there isn't much of a personal connection to it.
I think it's very true. I mean, I don't have a lot of memories of those days. I'll give another example of that. I didn't find out until a few years back in my hometown that a black church had been firebombed back in 1968. Well, I didn't know it, I was shocked to hear it. And so those are the kind of things that I found out along my journey. It's been kind of fascinating.
Yeah.
As kids, you're out running around the playground and, you're not focused on it. And I always say it's almost like it took place in some alternate universe, but I think that's what maybe lent itself to the outrage as well.
Yeah.
That's what really fueled me, is the fact that it's always kind of stuck in my craw and people got away with crime, especially murder.
Well, and it also seems to be that now the people living in the South, many people living in the South are of another generation. Maybe they don't have the personal connection, but they do have this sense that something here was wrong, and justice was, even in the cases where there were people were charged and there were trials, justice wasn't served. And there are probably a lot of people who would say, like you did, that, there's something wrong with that, and people should not be able to get away with murder.
Yeah, we should be able to walk away and not ever be tried for murder, and when they've done it. And I think what made these cases, from an injustice standpoint, really outraged me is the fact that it's not just these guys got away with murder. It was the fact that everybody knew they were getting away with murder. And I think that's what really makes it such a horrible injustice.
Well, then I suppose that leads to the question was, in going back and looking at these cases, is it a case that for you or for the prosecutors then who end up charging someone, that is it the case that evidence is there and it's available and all you got to do is look at it? Or is it the case that then that you're, as a result of your work and other people's work, you're actually turning up new evidence?
Well, it's both. And to be frank, I mean, I think the easiest cases to re-prosecute have been those that were thoroughly investigated at the time, or even if there was a trial. And the reason for that is you end up with a transcript. And if you have a transcript, then that testimony, that sworn testimony, can be used even if those people are dead. I know it sounds kind of wild, but it's true. So those kinds of things, and usually they're not, it's not critical testimony. It's just, some kind of, tangential testimony that they're used for. But it's been very fascinating to to watch this unfold. And the transcripts have certainly played a key role in these cases as well.
Our guest in this hour of Focus 580 is Jerry Mitchell. He's an investigative reporter for the Clarion Ledger newspaper in Jackson, Mississippi, and has been involved for a number of years now in looking at cold cases from the civil rights era. And as a result of some of the work that he's done and stories that he has written, eventually there have been indictments, there have been trials, and some people have actually been held accountable for murders that were committed during that time. Questions, comments, certainly welcome. 333-9455 and toll-free 800-222-9455. I think that probably the first really big story and case that you were involved with that maybe then set you on this road was the case of Byron De La Beckwith.
Yes, it was.
Who was convicted of killing Medgar Evers in 63.
No, he wasn't convicted.
He was arrested for it and tried for it.
But he walked away.
I meant the murder was in 1963.
Oh, yes, it's 63. 63. Was murder, yeah.
And then he was tried and convicted. That was 1991?
No, 94.
Yeah. Okay, 94.
That's all right.
So he was tried. He was convicted. He was sentenced to life in prison. He died in prison. And that one thing here that really got started and I want to talk about is the Mississippi State Sovereignty Commission.
Yeah, that's really the other thing that really helped to fuel me. I don't know if you're like me, but if someone tells me I can't have something, I want it like a million times worse, you know? So there were all these sealed files involving the Mississippi Sovereignty Commission. Now, people probably don't know what that is, but what it was an agency that operated in the 50s and 60s and early 70s in Mississippi. It was basically a state segregationist spy agency. It was kind of one part propaganda agency and one part spy agency. And so basically they infiltrated civil rights groups and did a lot of nefarious stuff. And so all the records for that agency, which, by the way, was headed by the governor, were all sealed. And so nobody could get them. I mean, they were sealed till like 2027. And then there was a lawsuit going on to try to unseal them, and that was still rocking on at the time. Anyway, so that's what led me. I began to develop sources who began to leak me those files. And that's what led to that first story that I did on the Medgar Evers case, which showed that at the same time the state of Mississippi was prosecuting Byron De La Beckwith for the killing of Medgar Evers, this other arm of the state, the Sovereignty Commission, was secretly assisting the defense, trying to get Beckwith acquitted, and nobody knew that. And as a result of that, the case got reopened.
So
that was October. My story ran October 1st, 1989.
Mm-hmm. So all of this material, the records from the Sovereignty Commission, were they just sitting in a room somewhere?
No. I had them leaked to me, yeah.
No, but I mean, did someone had them stuffed away?
Well, yeah, it was they were sealed over. The state agency had them, and so I got somebody to leak them.
Someone decided it was important for that to come out, and so
so that's how I got them.
Yeah, and so this must have been an enormous, not just for this particular case, but a huge trove of kind of information about what.
Solely, it was kind of the initial stuff I got were kind of dribs and drabs of it. I got like, you know, a story here and a story there. And eventually, by the end of 1989, I loaded up my little hatchback Honda with 2,400 pages of Sovereignty Commission records. I always called it those records. I called them kind of the Sovereignty Commission's greatest hits. I mean, it was kind of like the highlights of some of the worst things they did.
Hmm. And did that, not only for you, but for a lot of people, did that open people's eyes to what really had happened at that time?
Oh, absolutely. And in fact, one of the more interesting things that came out in that was I found out the Clarion Ledger, where I work, was a horrible racist newspaper. And I didn't really know some of the newspaper's past. And so that obviously brought me into contact with that. So we actually did a story about ourselves.
So what the newspaper was actually cooperating with the commission?
Absolutely, the whole way, and even getting reports directly. Running the commission would send them, you know, information for stories, and they'd print it verbatim, things like that. It was pretty awful.
Hmm. And needless to say, it's a very different paper now.
Yes. Thank God. It's a much different paper. It had changed drastically before I ever got here, and I got here in 86.
Yeah. And the newspaper, the editors, the people that you work for, they've all along have been very supportive of the kind of things that
absolutely.
You've been doing.
Absolutely. I've had a tremendous amount of support here for my work, and I appreciate that. Yeah. And I couldn't, you know, if they hadn't been supportive, I couldn't have done it, and certainly, you know, wouldn't have gotten the grant like I just did from MacArthur Foundation.
Mm-hmm. So maybe you could talk just a little bit more about the death of Medgar Evers and Byron D. LeBeckwith.
Sure.
And his involvement.
Sure. Medgar Evers was a field secretary for the Mississippi NAACP, and he took on that job in 1954, not that long after Brown versus Board of Education. And at that moment in time, taking that job was almost like a death sentence. I mean, because the NAACP at that moment was basically an underground organization. You know, if you couldn't publicly belong to it and survive. And he was actually the front man. I know Merle Evers has told me stories about how people would actually, if they were walking down the sidewalk and they saw that Megger was walking down the same sidewalk, they would actually cross the street just so they wouldn't be seen on the same sidewalk with him. And so Byron D. LeBeckwith killed Megger Evers, and he basically and this was the same night that President Kennedy spoke to the nation about no longer treating Americans as second-class citizens. And that same night is when Byron D. LeBeckwith shot Medgar Evers in the back at outside his Jackson home. He just arrived home back from listening to a speech with some other civil rights leaders. And he got home, and as soon as he got out of the car, he was shot in the back by Beckwith. And then Beckwith ditched the gun, you know, went away, and the gun that he ditched, I mean, had his fingerprint on it. He had left his fingerprint on the rifle. So he ended up being eventually arrested and tried in that case.
And in that first go round,
right.
Was there was a hung jury. Was it? Or
yeah,
was
it was a hung jury. Yeah. He was actually tried twice in 64, and there were a couple of Greenwood policemen who basically gave him an alibi. They basically claimed that that they had seen him in Greenwood, Mississippi, which is where Beckwith lived, which was like 2 hours away, that they had seen him there at like 1:05 in the morning or something like that, or some ridiculous exact time. That they didn't connect anything, which I always thought was pretty transparent on its face that they were lying for him.
And how many at the time? How many people do you think you could have said probably knew that he was guilty of this crime?
Everybody knew he was guilty.
Everybody.
I mean, anybody you talk to would say, "Oh, yeah, Beckwith did it." I mean, you know, they would just even people who opposed the case being re-prosecuted. I mean, you know, people would say, "Oh." Beckwith did it, you know. They need to try it again. Well, no, you know. We don't need to dig up the past, you know. That would be kind of the mentality of it.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and unless you had some, you know, bizarre conspiratorial person who believed that, you know, someone planted it so Beckwith would be planted Beckwith's gun with his fingerprint so he would be blamed on him. But yeah, he was seen there at the scene, and you know, just his car was seen, and yeah, everything. I mean, they had him dead to rights.
And so, and then when he was retried,
he bragged about it too. On top of that, I might add,
he actually told people.
Yeah, he bragged about it. I think there were like 6 witnesses who testified that he bragged about it. So,
then when he was tried, I guess would have been the third time.
Yeah, in 94.
Convicted in 94. Then was all that evidence that might well have been presented, or maybe was presented, or should have been presented the first time around, just laid out, and so that it was very clear there was really no question?
He had all these witnesses he'd bragged to in the meantime, and that all came out, including one of the people he bragged to was a prison guard in Louisiana, because Beckwith went to prison for taking a ticking time bomb and trying to plant it outside a Jewish leader's home in New Orleans. So he bragged about it to this guy, too. It's just amazing.
So, one, I guess, maybe it has to do with the passage of time. Maybe it has to do with people feeling like it was time for justice to be done, for people actually to start saying things that they in 1963 that they never would have said.
I think that's absolutely it, and people felt safer too. I think there's a certain amount of that as well. That at the time they didn't feel safe speaking up.
And I guess that leads to the question: why is it that people feel safe now, or is there reason now for people to?
Well, Mississippi, for example. I mean, Mississippi is not the same place it was in 1963, 1964. At that moment in time, you know, there were very few African Americans who could vote in the state, and certainly none that served on juries because they were barred. In fact, women didn't begin to serve on juries in Mississippi until 1968. Kind of interestingly. But now Mississippi has more black elected officials than any other state. So it's really kind of fascinating to see the transformation. Does that mean Mississippi has arrived or anything like that? No. I don't know that any of us have arrived. I think it's a process. But I think Mississippi probably has changed more than any other state.
Hmm. At the same time, I know from having read about it that certainly there were people who were angry about the stories that you've done.
Oh, yeah.
They're
Believe
angry
me, I've
at you.
Met plenty
They're
of people angry.
Angry at the newspaper.
They still get angry at me.
Yeah. Well, and I'm sure that they all sort of say the same thing. They say, you know, what's the point? Who's helped by going back and digging up the past? It makes Mississippi look bad.
Right.
You know, all that
digging,
kind of stuff.
Digging up dirt. It's just, yeah. you're opening old wounds and stuff like that. And I think that Merle Evers probably had the best point on that. And what she said, this is the widow of Medgar Evers, her point on that was, look, this is an infection. And until you go back in and clean out the infection, the wound never heals. I think that's a decent point.
Yeah, I think there's a nice quote here. Apparently, in his closing arguments, the prosecutor, when Beckwith was tried here for this third time, he said, "Is it ever too late to do the right thing?"
Yeah, that's what Bobby DeLauder said in his closing.
Yeah, that at the same time, of those people who think, you know, what's the point of going back? Is
sure.
Is it that they somehow still feel strongly about segregation,
yeah,
or race relations, or is it mostly that it makes them so uncomfortable, it makes everybody look
bad? I think
bad.
That's it. I mean, I give you an example. Yeah. I was talking to a woman one day, and she told me, you know, what are you doing? I can't believe you're doing this. And, you know, really upset with me that I would even write about this. And I never take any criticism personally, or try not to, and so I just hear people out. And while we were talking, she mentioned that her daughter had been murdered, and I was like horrified. This is horrible. That's terrible. And she told me, explained a little bit about it, that the guy that she believed did it was acquitted, which means he couldn't be retried. He was found not guilty. And so I said, well, if it was possible to go back and try this guy again, would you be for it? She was like, oh, yeah, absolutely, absolutely. I said, don't you think these families feel the same way you do?
And did that make an impression on her?
Could she make
the connection between her experience and
an impression on her? Uh-huh. I hope so. I mean, that was my point. You know, yeah, you understand it with your daughter. Just think how somebody else feels, you know, if their son was killed.
We're at our midpoint of this part of Focus 580, and again, I just want to go back, and for anybody who has just tuned in, and introduce again our guest, Jerry Mitchell. He's an investigative reporter for the Clarion Ledger newspaper in Jackson, Mississippi, and has done a lot of investigative work on cold cases, murders, unsolved murders from the civil rights era, and he's gotten a lot of recognition for his work, more than 30 national awards. He's received a MacArthur Foundation Genius Grant, won the Sigma Delta Chi Award for Public Service, the Haywood Bruin Award. He has won the Polk Award. He was a finalist in 2006 for the Pulitzer Prize, and has also talked a lot about the work that he's done. And questions are certainly welcome, 333-9455, and toll-free 800-222-9455. Tell us about the case of Bobby Cherry and the Birmingham church bomb.
Sure, sure. Well, Bobby Cherry was one of the last living suspects in the Birmingham church bombing that took place in 1963, and that was the one that killed the four little girls. You know, the bomb, the Klan planted the bomb in the church and it blew up and killed four little girls on a Sunday morning. So he was one of the last living suspects, and he got in contact with me, wanted me to talk to him, and he lived near Tyler, Texas, which is not that far from where I grew up. And so I drove over there from Mississippi, drove over there and met him and talked to him for probably about 6 hours. And he insisted on his innocence. And what he said was, you know, I didn't have anything to do with that church bombing. I left that sign shop. The sign shop he's talking about is about 2.5 blocks from where the church blew up. And it's also where they made the bomb. But anyway, he said, I left that sign shop at 9:45 because I had to get home and watch wrestling.
On television.
Yeah, on television. Yeah, he's talking about. Yeah. And so I got, even now, like, had a sworn statement from this woman. You know, I remember that night well. We're all sitting around watching wrestling. So I got back to the newspaper and talked to our librarian, Susan Garcia, and I said, Susan, just check with the Birmingham News and see what was on TV. And the next day, I got an email from Susan said, you know, there was no wrestling on television, you know, and it was really kind of amazing, you know. So the guy's alibi basically fell through.
And that's such a great story because it shows you that just a tiny little, this tiny little thing that I don't know if any, you know, who knows who else along the way would have thought to ask that same question. Say, well, okay, let's just find out. They're making a big deal about how they were watching this on television.
Yeah, exactly.
Let's just find out. Well, what was on television?
Exactly.
And you found out, in fact, no, there was no wrestling on television then.
Yeah, and that's what always mystifies me sometimes and as a reporter, that people just don't check things out. I mean, it's just like, to me, it's just basic, you know, kind of reporting. You know, you just, there's an old saying in the way they say it in the South is this, even if your mama says she loves you, check it out, you know. So it's you know, it's an old journalism saying.
Yes.
But that's the way they say it in the South.
Yeah.
And I think it's true. You just check things out. And I think the other thing it goes back to, and it's just for me personally, I think there is such a thing as truth. And you know, if somebody says there's wrestling on TV, either wrestling's on TV or wrestling's not on TV, you know. And if it's not on TV, then the guy's lying, obviously.
Yeah. Oh, they say it that same way in Chicago, by the way.
No, is that the way they say it?
Yeah, if your mother says she loves you, check it out. Yes. No, that, there's this, the story that's probably apocryphal that this famous news bureau in Chicago, they had that written on a sign up on the wall.
Oh, did they really?
Well, it's said. I don't think that that's really true, but of course we all like that.
Well, yeah.
That story.
Even apocryphal, it sounds like it ought to be true.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. So it amazes me in a little bit is that some of the people that you have talked to, people like Byron D. LeBeckwith or Bobby Cherry, would talk to you.
I know.
That is, that they would sit down and
Cherry actually saw.
He actually said,
it really blows my mind.
She wanted knowing you were this guy who had done these stories. He actually said, "Come on down and talk to me."
It as of that point, I guess I had done two cases, two different cases I had done. There had been convictions, but the only thing I think maybe he latched onto is I had done this story, kind of a narrative, serial narrative for the newspaper called "The Preacher and the Klansman," which was a story of. Guy's a preacher and a guy's a Klansman. It ends with them becoming friends. I mean, that's, you know, what it ends with. But of course, the guy's a Klansman doesn't certainly rejects his old ways. So I don't know if that's what he read, you know. I have no idea why he thought that, you know, he should be talking to me. But, you know, if they want to talk, I'll talk to them.
Well, it seems you wonder if partly it is they somehow feel this need to explain themselves.
They do.
Or if they feel somehow if they put it in the right terms that people will somehow see that maybe they weren't bad people. Or
I think that's exactly
something like that.
Everybody, I think there's a deep-seated need of everybody, whether Klansmen or whoever they are, to kind of tell their story. And I think this is an experience probably everybody who's in journalism has had, which is if somebody, you know, tells you you know, when you get done with an interview, let's say you've done a really extensive interview with somebody, and after a few hours, and they may come back at some point when you get to the end and say, you know, I hadn't even told my family that. And it sounds kind of shocking to people who aren't in journalism circles to maybe hear that, but for people who have been in journalism for a while, you know that's not uncommon, you know, that you do have people occasionally will do that, you know. And why is that? Well, because they kind of want to – everybody wants to share their story, and no one ever – nobody else takes the time to listen. Well, we as journalists, we kind of get paid to listen, so –
yeah, sometimes it seems that if you can get people into confessional mode, they'll just
absolutely
open
Jerry
up.
Jerry talked at length about being in the Klan and, you know, different things, and it was very fascinating. I'm very fascinated by all this, you know, these guys and how they operated and their mentality and how they justified what they did. I just did a series of guy who's a inmate next to Edgar Ray Killen, and Killen wrote him a bunch of stuff, and I've had, you know, it's expert analyzed, it is in fact Killen's handwriting, etc. And it's just fascinating, you know the way he justifies it was war, you know, it was war, and so therefore if you kill people, you're at war, that's part of war, you know. And so it's just kind of interesting, the fascination of people, how they justify what they did.
And he would kill, and this was the guy who was, it was the first person to be charged in connection with the murder.
Yeah, Edgar Ray Killen was right. He was kind of the guy who orchestrated the killings of Mickey Schwerner and Andy Goodman and James Chaney, who are the three civil rights workers in 64 who were killed, sometimes called the Mississippi Burning case.
Mm-hmm. One of the most famous, or I don't know, maybe infamous is a better word, killings,
sure,
of this whole time.
Absolutely. You know, certainly one of the most nefarious, probably the most infamous triple slaying, certainly here in Mississippi.
When you have sat down and talked to the kind of people that we're talking about,
right,
I'm sure that what you have to do as you're sitting there and listening to them tell their story is be as kind of blank and neutral as,
yeah,
possible, because you want them to...
Yeah, you don't want to say you're a racist. Yeah. You're a racist Klansman. What are you saying this for?
But inside, is that what you're thinking yourself? God, what, you know?
Oh, yeah. Well, I know when I interviewed Byron Dietl Beckwith, he's horribly, horribly racist in just everyday conversation. I mean, the N-word this, and I mean, just, I'll give you a quick sample of Beckwith. You know, he said, well, you know why all those N-word churches all burned? Well, he said, you know why all those, you know, N-word churches burned in the 60s? I was like, no. He said, N-words are careless with matches, you know. And so, you know, it's just ridiculous, you know. And so I found myself, I was horrified by it, but it was so ludicrous, I found myself laughing. And I think he thought he was being entertaining, if that makes sense.
Yeah, no, yeah, he thought you were with him, and you were
right,
just sort of horrified to the point
horrified by what he's saying, yeah. you know. So he was a piece of work, that's for sure.
Did it, when you were doing that interview or some of these interviews, were you sitting there thinking that you were in a potentially dangerous place or with a potentially dangerous person?
Yeah, I guess I don't try to think that way. I try to be relaxed and try to make them relaxed. And that's why it's also not a bad idea to interview people at their houses. Now, Edgar Ray Killen, he wanted me to come talk to him at night, and I was kind of like, nah, it's okay. So I actually took him and his wife out for catfish. So anyway, you know, but I'm a believer in that. I think you take people out to eat, you know, meet with them in their homes and just get them to relax and to talk. And I think the one thing that's to my advantage is the fact that I'm, personality-wise, I'm kind of the opposite of Mike Wallace. You know, I'm kind of real laid back and, you know, for lack of better terms, I don't like being called this, but I guess I am a good old boy in probably a lot of ways.
Well, that's in this particular case, it sounds like that works for you in the sense that these people are feeling they're comfortable enough. I don't know if it's necessarily they're sort of sitting there thinking that you're like them or you're of the same stock or, you know, whatever it is. But clearly, you have been more successful than no doubt you know, I would be, or somebody from outside would have been.
Well, I was going to say anybody. You had to be kind of a white Southern WASP. Like Beckwith, I had to pass a quiz to even talk to him. You know, and I, of course, I knew I would be able to pass. You know, that I would pass with flying colors because he asked all his personal stuff, like where did you grow up, what are your parents' names, and you know, where do you go to church, where do you live, all that kind of stuff. And so I just, you know, I knew, it's kind of one of those things. I had to decide, am I going to really answer these questions or not? And I thought, well, heck, he'll love my answers, you know, and because I was basically had this really, you know, conservative Christian upbringing. And so, I passed with flying colors.
Well, in both these cases, these were men who were at continuing to maintain their innocence, that they were
correct,
not guilty of these things. So they no doubt also thought that they could tell you the same story that they had told before, and that
exactly,
would again it would be a way to bolster the alibi, or you know, whatever story that they have told, like with Bobby Cherry and his thing about how no, I couldn't have done that, I was not anywhere near there, I was
right,
at home,
exactly,
and we were all sitting around watching TV. They thought, well, if I just tell the story to this guy one more time, that'll help solidify the story. But obviously there's some little chink in there that manages to appear.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think that's it. I think people, you know, want to profess their innocence even if they're guilty sometimes. You know, they feel like if they do it loud enough that people will believe them. You know, I'm not really sure. I don't really understand that mentality, but anyway.
Going back, I just again wanted to go back.
Sure.
You said in the beginning you talked about the fact that you were there at the paper at the Clarion Ledger, and you were working as a courts reporter, and you hadn't really done this kind of stuff. And but the thing that really made this huge impression on you was when you saw the film Mississippi Burning,
mm-hmm,
which was about the Cheney Goodman Schwerner killing, and clearly moved you. And that then I went on to say, and what's really amazing is later on you would actually manage to meet the person.
Edgar Ray
Killen, who was first to be charged in this.
Yeah, I know, and as it was I guess my philosophy with all these cases has been, whoever the suspect is, I try to contact them early and sit them down and talk to them. You know what I mean? And if it's possible. And you know, that's my mentality. I want to sit down and talk to him, because I think that a lot of times you can you get more information that way than you're going to get if you come in there, like I said, you know, with guns blazing and you know the microphone and the camera and everything. And I've never understood that mentality of journalism anyway. It's like you're more interested in making a guy look guilty than you are in, you know, get him to sit down and talk. And I'm more interested in getting him to sit down and talk, you know.
Was there something in particular that emerged from your conversations with him that turned out to be really important?
Yeah, well, I think so. Edgar Killen, when I asked him, you know, of course, if he had anything to do with the killings of three civil rights workers, and he said no. And then I asked him, well, what do you think should happen to those who were responsible? And he said, well, I'm not going to say they were wrong. And that just really struck me, you know. And then he proceeded to tell this story about himself. When Martin Luther King was assassinated in 1968, the FBI at that time didn't know who was responsible. So they literally sent out agents all over the country. Well, two of them showed up at the doorstep of Preacher Killen, Edgar Ray Killen, wanting to know his whereabouts on April 4th, 1968. Well, Killen wouldn't talk to him, but the agents left their card. Time goes on. Killen picks up the card one day, calls the agent, wants to know who killed King. And the agent's like, why do you want to know? And Killen says, man, I want to shake his hand. And I share that story to let people know, you know, sometimes we see the video of these guys, and I have people that I know will say, like, Jerry, why don't you just leave these old guys alone? And the thing you have to remember is these were young killers who just happened to get old.
And they're people who seem some of the, I don't want to make sweeping generalizations, but there are people who've seen that they're actually still, in a sense, they're proud.
They are.
Of what
I think Killen is proud of what he did. Yeah, he's made that clear. He's proud of what he did. He's not ashamed of what he did. He still believes that he did the right thing. So this is not like a case where you've got a remorseful killer or something like that, which is a different matter, I think.
We have about 10 minutes left in this part of Focus 580 with our guest Jerry Mitchell. He's an investigative reporter for the Clarion Ledger in Jackson, Mississippi. He's written a lot of stories about unsolved murders from the civil rights era, and as a result of some of the work that he's done, there actually have been, these cases have been reopened, there have been trials, there have been convictions, and he's won a lot of awards for his work, including most recently a MacArthur Foundation Genius Grant. Questions welcome. We have somebody here ready to go. 333-9455 and toll free 800-222-9455. Here's someone to talk with in Urbana, line one.
Good morning.
Yes.
I'm fascinated by this look at a grim part of American history. And the fact that you said that these men regarded themselves as warriors, but then the acts that they did were absolutely dishonorable, cowardly.
Absolutely.
And there's like a total disconnect, apparently, from mm-hmm. what you have described.
Mm-hmm.
And I've got to wonder if somehow, at some very strange level of society, this goes forward like this. The people you describe sound a little bit like Eric Robert Rudolph, the bomber.
Absolutely. I think you're right. I think that's what we are talking about. There has to be kind of this mentality that justifies murder or terrorism. I never got the impression that Timothy McVeigh was sorry for what he did, and obviously he killed, 168 people.
And I would like to think that this type of murder, was... in the past, but then you have the 88-year-old racist who shot a guard at the Holocaust Museum because he was angry about his Social Security, and there's no connection there either. But he felt there was one, so
right. The mentality hasn't gone away, and I think that's an excellent point, and I think that's what's going on. Is you see those kind of acts. You see the daycare out in Los Angeles that was shot up. You see the guy went around, talk about Chicago and that area up in the Midwest. I mean, there was the guy that drove around and started shooting people.
Oh, yeah. He was through this area here and killed himself in his car.
Right, exactly. And so... It's the same kind of mentality. We haven't talked about it yet, but I don't mind mentioning it now. There's a certain number of these guys, including like Beckwith, who believe in what's called Christian identity. I don't know if you've heard of that or not.
In passing,
a lot of these guys, and this is basically a white supremacist religion, and so it goes beyond the Klan. It goes to a lot of groups, including modern people up to through today. And the mentality is that they believe. And I'll state all this pretty bluntly, so I'm hopefully not hurting anybody's feelings on this. But this is what they believe. It's horribly racist, but this is what they believe. They believe that Adam and Eve were white people. They believe that blacks and other non-whites were created on the sixth day with the animals, and therefore they don't have souls. And they believe that Jews are the offspring of Satan. And what they believe is that Eve mated with the serpent Satan, and that's where Jews came from.
Well, that's totally warped.
It's just sick.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, thank you.
All right. Thanks for the call.
Bet.
In your response to the caller, you used a word, and it was a word that was kind of in my head as well, in as one word you could use to describe what it is we're talking, these crimes that we're talking about, and that is terrorism. Do you think, that these things indeed qualified as terrorism?
Yeah, and it's fascinating. We won't ever call it that, or like, you know, kind of was real fascinating to me to watch the Oklahoma City thing unfold, because Oklahoma City bombing, because, you know, the very first thing everybody said was that this was the act of foreign terrorist. Mm-hmm. And then when we found out that Timothy McVeigh and others were involved in this, then they didn't call it terrorism anymore. And I've never understood that. How did it suddenly get disqualified, you know?
Well, either that or, you know, I suppose if you're going to hedge your bet, so you can call it domestic terrorism, as if somehow
you want to call it domestic different. Terrorism, fine, but it's still terrorism.
Yeah. Right. Let's talk with, we have two other callers. We're trying to get them both. Next is Champaign, line two. Hello?
Yes, I have kind of some comments for our guest and then a couple questions. I went to college in San Antonio in the late 60s, and I also lived in Houston. And so traveling around in Texas in the South, I saw racism at its absolute ugliest against blacks and Hispanics. And we white people can talk about whether these, you know, white supremacists and our races are terrorists, but they are. For the people who are being discriminated against, their fear is palpable. It is visceral fear. At least it was when I lived in the South years ago. My family still lives in San Antonio, and I know that racism is rampant. They may put it under the surface, but we can tell from the last presidential election that they're out there in droves, and all you need to do is just have a Sarah Palin throwing out, you know, the red meat to these people, and they will surface. And so my questions, though, for the guest are, have you noticed any difference in attitudes in ability to prosecute cases between the Clinton administration and the Bush administration? And have you ever personally feared for your life?
In terms of administrations, you know, I guess we're just now, you know, I think there's been support from both administrations so far. So in terms of these cases, so I don't know that I could beat up on the Bush administration for that.
Okay.
With regard to the other question, in fact, I might add as well about these cases. These cases have kind of been nonpartisan in the sense that they have been prosecuted by both Democrats and Republicans. So it's not been a one-way street on that. In terms of fear for my life, I mean, I think I had you know, I had Beckwith threaten me. I had some other threats early on. It kind of was a decision I kind of had to make early on. I continue to, by the way, I have one guy still making death threats to me and stuff like that. And I think it's just one of those things. Yeah, I had to decide early on whether I was going to let that intimidate me or not. I think I was always the runt on the playground. I was always the kid that got the crap beaten out of him. And I think I've always, for that reason, I've always reacted pretty poorly to bullies, and I know that when people do that kind of stuff, they're trying to bully me, and so I have the opposite reaction. When people try to bully me, it makes me more determined to do what I'm doing.
Well, I want to thank you for what you're doing.
Well, thank you very much.
Because somebody has to stand up and do it, and I'm so glad that you are.
And, I appreciate that.
And thank you for being on this program and enlightening us.
Very good. Well, and thank you for the call. Let's go on here. I got one more I want to try to get, and that's Urbana, line three. Hello.
Oh, hi. How are you? I want to reiterate, thank you for your work. I know of these people, and probably through you, either vicariously or through, you know, other people that have written about what you've written about. And it's really interesting because I had a friend who, I'm 60 years old, and when I was in the military 40 years ago, the draft was going on, and when I was in induction, I went twice to induction centers, and I noticed that the young black kids who were marginally, let's say, they barely made the IQ test, they would be, treated like bullied by the military people there or the civilian doctors. And then during basic, they would separate these people out and sort of use them as fodder in infantry units. I always found that real interesting. There's sort of a social, like a military quasi societal, fodder, expendable people. You send them
right.
and get slaughtered. And I met some of these people and didn't work with them directly. They were more like support, or I ran across them in combat situations and stuff. And when I came back, I had this overwhelming feeling for their, empathy for them and sympathy for them, because they were victimized, I think, by the system. And that sort of is like what you talk about in the South, because I had a friend who was born in Mobile. I was a military brat, so, and I went down South with him in this, after I got out of the military in the early 70s. And the racism, as a woman earlier said, it's just, I mean, blacks down there, like, they just, the way that back then, they were so deferential to white people, because I think there was this underlying, you didn't do what they told you to do. They would just basically shoot you. And what I think now is it's sort of like with this whole tea bag thing, or whatever, the tea party thing.
Yeah,
or whatever
tea party.
Is underlying that is a racism, with all these pictures like Obamacare, treating him like the, victimizing him in photographs, like the Joker from the late recent Batman film. And it comes off as sort of like there's this incredible racism still here, and you are really good about pointing this out. I want to thank you for that.
Well, thank you very much. There was a really good book that came out years ago, and I read it, but I don't have a copy of it. I need to get a copy of it. But it was by Sam Keen. It's called Faces of the Enemy, and what it is, it shows all of the World War II propaganda, whether the Germans or the Japanese or the Americans, all of them. And basically, what you notice is commonality of depicting the enemy as the monster. And so, whenever people start depicting the enemy as the monster, it dehumanizes them, and therefore makes it easier to kill them or justify things done against them.
I'm sorry to say we're going to have to stop, because
that's
we've
okay.
come to the end of the time, and all we can do is say thanks to Jerry Mitchell, our guest for this part of the show. I really appreciate you giving us some of your time. Jerry works for the Clarion Ledger newspaper in Jackson, Mississippi. It's online, by the way, if people want to take a look at the paper. We certainly thank you for your time and wish you well.
Thank
for
you.
And you're planning on continuing to do this?
Yes, I am. In fact, I've just did a couple stories that ran Sunday and Monday on what I mentioned before about Edgar Ray Killen speaking to his cellmate, and I'm continuing to pursue the story. There are four suspects still alive in the Mississippi burning case.
And that's it. And at the same time, a lot of people are suspects and witnesses are dying, so it seems like the clock's kind of running on these stories.
Absolutely, and I'm also writing a book about it, and so hope to have that out within the next few years.
Well, again, thanks very much for your time. We appreciate
it. Thank you.